The HESS committee meeting will start today, April 5th, 2005, at 3:07. And let the record reflect that Seaton, McGuire, Coring, and myself, Wilson, are present. So we do have a quorum. And my committee staff that I have here helping me today are Kathy Hope Erickson, Alan Nodder, and Chris Spannon. And on our agenda today, we are going to try to go through three bills and the governor's appointment at the end. So without further ado, I actually am going to try to move House Bill 14, House Bill 214, and the governor's appointment. We will hear House Bill 13, but we'll hold it and for further discussion. So anyway, we'll start out with House Bill 14, Disclosures by Foster Parents by Representative Norman Rochberg. And his aide, Heather Navarra.
Navarra.
Just about got there, but not quite.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Norman Rochberg from District 27 in Anchorage. And before your House Bill 14, Madam Chair, this was brought to our attention when we were reviewing the multiple problems of the Office of Children's Services this last fall. As a matter of fact, the majority leader and I just had a press conference with Commissioner Gilbertson on Representative Coghill's Family Rights Act, which is a 38-page major rewrite of our... yes, you're familiar with that, are you not? Yes, at any rate. At the time when we consolidated into the omnibus bill, I made the decision not to include this particular provision in that omnibus bill because it was peculiar to the legislature. And this really grants and gives us as legislators and our staffs further access to information from foster parents, which currently are unable to directly converse with us about those matters that relate to a child in need of aid or a child under their care. So I bring that before the committee for your consideration. And with me is my staff, Heather Nobrega. And Heather, do you want to add anything about what this bill does and why we introduced it?
For the record, Heather Nobrega, staff to Representative Rochberg. It's pretty straightforward. It does allow for foster parents to actually call our office to talk to us about a child under their care. Currently, they're not even allowed to give us the child's name or any information about the child. They have to talk in code if they need our help. And so we're just trying to give them the ability to be able to contact our office and seek help, as does, you know, everyone else can contact our office and seek help. So we're just trying to allow them to have the same opportunity. There is the Department of the Office of Children's and Family Services will be up here to talk to you. And there is one provision that in the bill on page 2, line 2, where we're opening up confidential and privileged information about the child or the child's family. They were very against having foster parents disclose confidential information about a child's family to us, information that they should not be sharing. And we are open to deleting the reference to the child's family and just so that they can call us about the child themselves, the child and not the family. So we are happy to delete reference to the child's family out of that portion in order to work with the OCS on the best way to do this bill. I mean, it's a pretty short bill. It basically is just making some conforming amendments in other places, but the bottom line is it is allowing foster parents to be able to call their legislator's office for help.
And Chair, I might point out that the right now the natural parents can do that, and we can talk to them, but not foster parents. Also, I was approached by Representative Gardner, and at this point that she's not present, she did talk to me about offering an amendment in your committee about guardian ad litems. But she's had experience of that, and so I'll defer to her, but I would prefer to have see this bill move along. I know we have the chairman of the Judiciary Committee amongst your membership, so she may wish to take that up in the future, but I want to offer that amendment. So if you have any questions, be happy to answer it, and we'll defer testimony to the division. Thank you.
Any questions by the committee? Representative Corrin?
Representative Roegberg, do you or your staff any reason as to why the state is reluctant to provide that information? You'd think they would want to work for the betterment of the welfare of the child and recognizing that foster parents are often better than the natural parents in raising those kids. So what is the reason for the reluctance? Any idea?
Well, through the chair, Representative Corrin, I think the major thing is you've probably had a good lesson, you know, when reviewing the Family Rights Act as to the issue of confidentiality. I believe that the current prohibitions on communications are a result of the state's policy of confidentiality, which I believe as a matter of policy have overreached and created a veil basically of secrecy when we're trying to now as a matter of policy of this legislature pierce that and create a more transparent situation, which means that legislators can assist not only parents but foster parents by the nature of this bill. So I hope I've answered your question there.
I think adequately. I think it's a good bill.
Representative Seaton.
Yes. Thank you. Representative Roegberg, is there any difference in the groupings of people that are now, I mean, the governor, lieutenant governor, legislator, is there, or in the ombudsman, is there any criteria or prohibition on those named people from releasing information that wouldn't apply to a legislator or staff? I guess what I'm wondering is we have a grouping of people, the governor, the lieutenant governor, legislator, or ombudsman, that are named on page 1, lines 9 and 10. And I'm wondering whether it could go to expanding that to a legislator's staff. If those staff people are under the same legal constraints that are there for disclosure by the named person, the named categories on lines 9 and 10.
I try to defer to my counselor here. I think I know, but let Ms. Dobrig answer.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, if you look on page 2, line 16, there is a prohibition for any of those that this information is disclosed to from them further disclosing that information to someone who isn't authorized to receive it. So it says a person to whom the disclosure is made under this section.
Which line are you on, please?
Page 2, line 16.
Okay.
It'd be a little subsection 4.
Do you want to have criminal or civil penalties for disclosure? $500 in offense.
We'll defer to the agency. I'm sure they'll know what's under Title 47. I'm sure it's criminal.
I'm sure it is, too.
Gosh.
Does that answer your question, Representative Seaton?
I believe so. Maybe.
Okay.
And if the agencies have any other answer for that, we'd ask them as well, too. But I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah, I think that takes care of it.
Amen, sir.
Is there anyone from the department that would like to testify on this? Come on up.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Tammy Sandoval, and I'm the Acting Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services, Office of Children's Services. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. House Bill 14 proposes to allow foster parents of children in the custody of the department to disclose privileged and confidential information regarding the child to a legislator or to a member of the legislator's staff for review or use in their official capacity. The department wants to be responsive to the needs of foster parents. It's from statute 4710.080Q. That clearly defines and limits what specific information foster parents are entitled to. They're entitled to the child's case plan, medical, mental health, educational information regarding the child to assist them in providing the proper care for that child, in addition to information to help assure the safety of that child and their own family safety. That same statute also clearly requires foster parents to maintain the confidentiality of records regarding a child placed in their home, except when the disclosure of those records is necessary to obtain medical and educational services for the child, for example, providing information to physicians. There are many avenues already in place for foster parents to allow their input into the decision-making process regarding a child in their care. They are a part of our regular case review system, which allows them to express any concerns that they have about the plan or the services being provided for children in their care. They are allowed to attend court hearings and provide testimony to the judge. They are welcome to contact their social worker, the social worker supervisor, a staff manager, the children's service manager, as well as the central office and myself. There are several avenues for foster parents to get their needs met. They have access to formal grievance process, which is now a part of House Bill 53 that we've included, and they have, if they feel they have issues with the department. Our experiences is foster parents don't typically resort to contacting legislators about services to children per se, that they're that foster parents can become very attached to the children they care for. There are times when this attachment results in foster parents not wanting the child to be reunited with their biological family or not agreeing with another permanency plan that we might put in place for the child. Foster parents may also disagree with the placement decisions that the department's making. When this happens, it can place the department and potentially you, legislators, in the middle of a very complicated situation. We are not suggesting that foster parents should not have the right to call their elected officials with complaints and or concerns about their interactions with us. The goal is to support them in the best of their ability. We want to respond quickly and resolve those issues that we can, issues about the application process, foster care licensure, issues about training needs, monthly foster care payments, or special funding requests for specific needs of the child, and issues related to the communication and support they are receiving from their social worker. Basically, we're taking a neutral position on House Bill 14, but questions its necessity and its impact to existing law, which requires foster parents to protect a foster child's confidentiality. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Let the record, before we proceed, let the record show that Representative Sisna and Gardner have joined us. Representative
Seaton.
Oh, good.
I think you heard the question that I asked Representative Ropeberg, sponsor of the bill, and I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't a difference of opinion here on any different ability or of the staff and the governor, lieutenant governor, or legislator from the information, receiving the information, or what they could do with the information. And is your opinion that the line 16 and I guess the 16-17 on page 2 take care of that and now include those legislative staff in that same criteria that would be for a legislator?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that's our understanding as well. Just with regard to member of legislator staff, page 1, line 12, we believe that it says employee of these persons, and so we wondered at one point, but not a big deal. We wondered, you know, why they were pointed out as someone different than an employee of these persons, but not a critical matter. But with regard to page 2, line 16, we believe that those are criminal statutes that apply.
So in other words, they're already covered whether we put that in there or not.
I guess I'm not entirely sure what was intended, but we believe that in our look at what that says, we believe that they would be covered with the employee of these persons.
Okay. Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my my question would be, we get materials. We, or certainly in the past, I have gotten materials from the division on constituent issues, foster parents, and that's not anything really recent, but I have hung on to those, and I've got them in a locked place, and I hold on to them because I don't have a shredder in my office, and I am really interested in what, because I've never had any training on this, I'm not aware of any legislators having training on this, but I think the disposal of that information is probably pretty, it's pretty critical to keep things confidential. And I think a shredder is a good thing to use if you've got confidential information like that. What is the standard that you would recommend for legislators in that kind of situation?
Representative Sisna, through the chair, I don't know if I have a recommendation about that. I don't know what guides how you keep records. If there's anybody in the audience who can help me with that. But
the HIPAA Act come into this.
Well, I actually bought a shredder myself and shred my own.
Yeah, well, I don't have a shredder, and I guess maybe we should get, rules could do that. No.
$30.
The rules chair will take care of it.
We should have a guideline for legislators, though. Pardon me, Madam Chair. Through the chair.
And did I understand that the department was in favor of the change suggested by the sponsor to remove for a child's family from the legislation?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes, we are very much in favor. That's why we have a neutral position at this point, because we think that we were opposed to include the child's family, and that's been something that we've talked with Representative Rookberg's office about and have come to have a common place on that regard.
Any other questions? There's no one online to testify. Is there anyone else in the room to testify? Representative Sisna?
I might make a comment, and that is that I just got back from the Child Welfare League's meeting in San Diego on the performance measures that were a result of the federal review. And one of the things that the states talked about, the various states that we're talking about, what they've been doing, is the recognition of the imbalance of power, and they were talking more about the natural parents, but I personally think that also applies to foster parents, that if in fact you have a placement, you do, as a former foster parent, I can say you love these kids. You'd fight to the death for them in many cases, and you go to bat for them. And if there's a disagreement between you and the caseworker, there's always that feeling that you're going to lose this child. So the power is definitely, there is an imbalance, and that's kind of one of those things that I think this bill makes way for there being a third party kind of coming in there, and legislators sometimes can come in and it kind of equalizes things a little bit. It kind of brings that power balance a little bit more at a level place, which is, and that's more of a comment than it is, but you might have something.
May I respond?
Please.
Representative Sisna, through the chair. I think that what I was referring to earlier about that's why foster parents are invited and often encouraged to come to court hearings where the judge is that neutral party, not to say that wouldn't also serve the same purpose, that they're able to contact your office, but there are other places where there are facilitated meetings, case review process, There's within our system, there are administrative reviews whereby they're facilitated by someone who sits outside of the case and looks objectively. We have a citizen review panel whereby they look at our system independently, judges on individual cases. There's any number of ways that foster parents can be heard by a neutral party, in addition to what you might be suggesting.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Madam Chair, the public hearing is closed, is that right? I'd like to move that we delete on page, conceptual amendment, on page one, line one, for a child's family, and also on page two, line two, page two, line 17, and anywhere else in the bill where that language or a child's family occurs, delete that from the bill. Okay.
Hearing no objection, that amendment has passed.
Anywhere else in the bill might be.
Just want to make sure we don't go too far. You just wanted to do it on page one, line in the title, and then also on page two, line two.
And then it's also on line 17.
It's also on line 11, which is part of the original.
Yeah, but that's not.
I mean, I think that one should stay.
Yeah, I think so too, yeah. Because okay. That's part of the original statute.
Just the one we're adding in should be the one that's taken out.
Okay. Now. We've already passed it, so I don't know. Can you withdraw it?
I'll rescind.
Can we do that after we've already passed it?
Yeah, you can rescind your.
Okay.
Just withdraw it.
Yeah. Okay. Representative.
Madam Chair, I get. Yeah, I don't know what you want to do. Do you want me to make a motion? I'll move that we rescind our action and adopting amendment number one.
Yep. Okay.
And now I'd like to make.
Yes,
like,
we did.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You guys are fat.
No moss growing here.
Okay, hearing no objection, that the original amendment has been rescinded.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to make a motion that we remove or delete the words or a child's family from page one, line one, and from page two, line two.
Hearing no objection, that amendment has passed. Okay, good. Representative Gardner.
I have a question. I actually kind of like this bill. And the reason is because when we ask foster parents to take a child, we ask them to take the child into their home, into their life, into their heart, to parent that child as they would their own children. And at the same time, their hands are kind of tied behind their backs. There's a movement now to address that, but they don't always get access to the information that they need to really, I mean, I know of cases, I'm a former foster parent too, where there's information about the child that could help the foster parent understand the child that they don't always have. But still, we say, treat this child as your own and do absolutely the best you can. And in asking them to do that, I think we need to leave all avenues that they see for advocating for the child open. And for that reason, I would say, yes, I would want them to be able to talk with the legislators, just as they might, I mean, I can't conceive of a lot of circumstances in which it would happen, but with their own children, if they wanted to talk to the legislator about it. And I think if we're going to say, treat this child as your own, treat them as your own. I mean, as much as you can in the child's interests.
Looking for a motion?
Yep.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 14 as amended. Individual recommendations and accompanying undetermined fiscal note, I guess it is. It's got asterisks in there as opposed to zeros. I assume it's zero. There should not be any expense involved. So, shall we just call it a zero fiscal note?
Undetermined.
Okay, hearing no objection to that, the bill has passed out of committee with individual recommendations and the fiscal note.
As amended.
Got to work on that, Mr. Rules Chairman.
The bill as amended.
You'll have to work on that.
All right. Thank you, Representative Roper.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we'll move on to House Bill 214, Anonymical Gifts and Representative Lisa McGuire.
Madam Chair.
You're going to have somebody else present your bill for you, okay?
I'm right here. Makes me work once in a while.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Vanessa Tandini, and I'm staff to Representative McGuire. And last year, most of you probably recall that the legislature passed the Anatomical Gifts Registry Bill. Can you not hear me? Last year, the Alaska legislature passed the Anatomical Gifts Registry Bill, which created, it's a good bill, and it created an official organ donor registry program at the Department of Motor Vehicles. And through the program, an organ donor's wishes are kept on record in a central database and are then transferred to Life Alaska Donor Services, which is the state's organ and tissue donor program. And this information allows Life Alaska to quickly match the donor's gift to a potential recipient and obviously saving time and lives. And this bill comes before you to make several simple but important technical changes to existing law to further the intent of the original enabling legislation and also to continue to move the donor registry forward in the state of Alaska. So this bill basically does a few things. It works to make, like I said, the donor registry more inclusive rather than exclusive. It offers expanded definitions that act to clarify the agencies that are actually responsible for donation within the state, as well as for people who are trained to do the actual recovery procedures. And it allows increased notification for greater donation potential. And it clears up some inconsistencies between federal regulations and state law. And if you'd like, I could go through the bill in more detail, or if you have any questions. We also have someone here, Bruce Sounarinas from Life Alaska, that could answer questions as well.
Good job.
I have a question. What exactly are the differences between the federal law and the state law?
Well, let's see here. That is in, let me look at the bill itself here. And Bruce, I don't know if you want to come up and speak to this as well. And I know, do you want to speak to the inconsistencies between federal law and state law that we're clarifying? Or I could go through the bill section by section. That might be, if it would be helpful, I could even just go through. I mean, the first main change that we're doing here, basically when Representative McGuire's original bill was submitted last year, and it was done so with the clear intent that the donor registry be operated from within the state, and not controlled by an out-of-state agency. And one of the changes we're making is, as the law now reads, an out-of-state organ procurement organization has sole control over the registry, excluding the in-state procurement organization, which is Life Alaska. So the first change this bill does, and I believe that's in sections one, anywhere you see organ procurement organization change to procurement organization. That's what we're doing there. And so it would basically just change 1350 to be inclusive rather than exclusive, allowing access to both in-state and out-of-state procurement organizations. And then, let's see, the current definition, so that was one thing, the definition of procurement organizations in 1350-190 and also 1352-390 are defined currently in law as the organization designated by the U.S. Department of Health and Social Services.
Health and Human Services.
Sorry. Get confused with this committee. And so basically that's the first change. And then also the definition of technician is being changed within 1352-390. Currently it's too restrictive and not in line with the laws of other states. Basically that recognized technicians throughout the state who recover tissues have never in fact been licensed or certified by the state medical board. And so, in fact, the state medical board doesn't have a process to license or certify these technicians to procure tissues. So we just change. And then getting to your question, I'm sorry, this is the long answer. But I think the FDA actually defines a technician under 21 CFR 1271-170. And this should all the federal regs should be in your bill packets that are provided. But they define it only by requiring establishments to employ sufficient personnel with the necessary education, experience, and training to ensure competent performance of their assigned functions. So we're kind of broadening it to go more in line with the federal regs there. And then let's see. I think AS 1352-200E only addresses notification to the hospital, so this would expand notification. We might talk about this further in some amendments, but it expands notification by allowing for law enforcement officers, firefighters, paramedics to also contact a procurement organization directly. And let's see, there are two paragraphs being repealed by the bill within 1352, and the first is 1352-200B. Let's see, that's the last section of the bill. That is actually in direct contradiction to 42 CFR 482.45, which requires that the hospital notify a procurement organization that will determine the suitability of donation on all deaths and imminent deaths. So basically, because we feel it's in contradiction with those regs, we might as well just not have it in there. And then the second we're repealing is 1352-200C, and basically that's just burdensome to the hospital, and it's duplicating the efforts already being done. So hope that helps.
Bruce, do you want to expand to the, through the chair, Madam Chair?
Representative McGuire.
When you walk through it, the first part, the procurement organization's easy to digest, the technician's easy to digest. But the part that you might want to add a little bit more testimony on is the part where we contradicted 42 CFR 482.45 on the notification requirements.
Representative McGuire, through the chair. The requirement nationally through CMS, now formerly HCFA, is that all deaths that occur in acute care hospitals, a notification is required to be made to the procurement organization. This is also including imminent deaths for the purpose of potential organ donation, where organs would be donated from somebody with a beating heart after death has been declared by brain death. So it includes deaths and imminent deaths. Determination of suitability is not the responsibility of the hospital, but in fact, the procurement organization, since such determinations change, and to educate hospital staff on who could and could not be a donor would be burdensome and difficult at best. So the simple requirement of the hospital is to call on all deaths or imminent deaths. And no caveat that they distinguish who could be a donor.
Thank you. Let the record show that Representative Anderson has joined us. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to say I'm really puzzled about this whole thing. It seems simple to other people, so maybe it's just me, but let me just clarify this. An organ procurement organization is federally defined. Is that
yes.
Correct? And so what we're doing is we're just taking the word organ out, and we're talking about procurement organization. And what that basically does is takes us outside of the federal organ procurement organization.
Well, it broadens the definition to allow inclusive an organization like Alaska with an organ procurement organization that is based out of state.
Right, but Life Alaska, excuse me, Madam Chair. Life Alaska is not an organ procurement organization. It's a procurement organization. That's basically it. Well, what puzzles me is we have a federal program that's nationwide that divides the country into regions for organ procurement and the registry. And I just don't understand why Alaska should be different. I mean, why we have to have our own when there's other regions all around the country that are functioning that don't have statewide organizations.
Madam Chair.
And Bruce, say your name for the record, too.
Bruce Zalnaratis, Life Alaska Donor Services. Because in Alaska, most donation is not organ donation, but in fact is tissue donation. Only a very small percent, about 10% of donation in Alaska is organ donation.
Uh-huh.
And so by having such a exclusion to an organization that does not represent tissue donation out of state, we feel that would be misrepresenting all donation in Alaska, of which organ and tissue are inclusive.
Representative, follow-up, Representative.
Yes, Gardner. Thank you. So the benefit to Alaska then is that the tissue donation registry is in Alaska. Is that
Well, donation registry. It's not distinct between organ or tissue. It's all donation.
Representative McGuire, why don't you add some comments here? You might clear that up.
I will. Yeah, I feel very strongly about this bill and about this part of the bill, Representative Gardner. Last year, we did yeoman's work to get a really fabulous organ and tissue donation registry in Alaska. We worked with the Division of Motor Vehicles and got them to work with us and to absorb a lot of these costs that would be, frankly, borne out by Alaskan taxpayers, all for the benefit of having an Alaskan organ and tissue donation registry right here within our state. To my complete embarrassment, as the bill worked its way through, there are frequently, well, organ and tissue donation has political roots to it as well, and I can tell you've already had conversations with some of the folks that are involved in that. The regional folks that control these like to control them and like to dictate where the organs and tissues go, and Alaska in particular has one of the higher rates of organ and tissue donation in the nation. In fact, the Northwest does, but Alaska in particular. So what happened is that Life Center Northwest, who was at that time our regional procurement organization, got an amendment in at the 11th hour that essentially dictated that all of our organ and tissue donation registry would have to go through them for all of their approval, for their sole proprietary control, and so on. Well, this ended up being a complete nightmare. I've spent the last 9 months during the interim trying to sort this out. And what ended up happening was our Division of Motor Vehicles, Dwayne Bannock, would work with his technical crew. They would get a system in place that would provide for this automated transfer. We had a big grand unveiling of this in September. We thought things were going fine. And all of a sudden, Life Center Northwest marches in my door and says, you know, we want changes to be made. We don't want it this way. We want it to run through our registry. And so their demand, essentially, of Dwayne Bannock and of our state resources would be that we would somehow go back in time, reconfigure the entire registry to then direct itself to an organization located in Seattle, Washington, to then redirect back to us to benefit our citizens. And it just, for the new members here, it just is a lesson in when you pass legislation to get in there with the finest tooth comb, because you cannot believe how many agendas are out there and these little amendments that people say, oh, this is just a small amendment, and suddenly the reality of it comes into play. So what this bill does is expands the definition, and right now we're working with Senator Murkowski and Senator Stevens to actually get a separate category for Alaska. But for right now, what this bill does is it allows us to continue on in the efforts that we've done. We've increased our organ and tissue donation rates up in the 80th percentile. We've had some phenomenal work going forward, and I don't want that work to be threatened. The intent all along was that Alaska, Life Alaska, our only organ and tissue donation center, would be the group that would go ahead and make the decisions and help work with our Division of Motor Vehicles. Again, Alaskans' expectation was that you use the resources of our Division of Motor Vehicles to work toward an Alaskan registry that benefits Alaskans and is controlled and maintained here, not somebody in Seattle, Washington. And so it is an issue that hits very close to home.
Madam Chair?
Representative Gardner.
Is it true, though, that we are not able to harvest organs ourselves, that a team comes up from Washington, and we also don't do transplants here?
We do transplants, but we do not do organ transplants.
Organ transplants. Okay, so if we have an organ donation program and we have to have somebody come from Washington to harvest it, and we also have to have someone from Washington, I guess the organs go out for transplant. I mean, if somebody in Alaska is going to have a transplant, they don't do it here. They would go to Washington
for organ transplants. That's correct.
For organ transplants. Okay. Well, then it seems to me that it would be reasonable to have the registry be in one place if the services are also there. I mean,
well, I'm sorry. Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the services are in both places. We do many tissue transplants in Alaska. We do corneal transplants, we do orthopedic transplants, we do vascular transplants, We do not do kidney transplants here. Those are done in Seattle or Portland or San Francisco. They're done all over the United States. So the transplants are done in both places.
Okay. And if, excuse me.
Follow up, Representative Gardner.
If we have organ donation information on our registry, is that available to the organ procurement organization?
Yes. In inclusive nature, they have full access to the registry to look up any name of any potential donor.
Okay.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you.
Well, I think I'm not understanding something. And Representative McGuire, I really am a little concerned because the quote was costs borne by Alaskan taxpayers. What taxes and what, how does this work? What kind of taxes would Alaskan taxpayers be required?
Representative Gardner. McGuire, go ahead and answer.
Sure. Representative Sisna, anybody, as you know, in the state of Alaska, we don't have a personal income tax. So nobody pays a personal income tax. But it might surprise you to know that all of the businesses in Alaska pay an income tax.
Well, those are businesses. Those aren't Alaskan
taxpayers. Sure. They're Alaskans. They absolutely are. Well, Alaskan business
The businesses
owners.
Wouldn't be paying the taxes on
no,
this.
No. Representative Sisna, what I was saying is that we are allowing a division of our government that we fund out of our general fund, which is in part a product of those taxes that Alaskans that own businesses, that own oil companies, that own small businesses, that pay into licensure and so on. I don't need to go into the litany of what's in the general fund.
I think it's really dangerous to talk about Alaskan taxpayers that way, because that sounds like individuals.
That's not the purview of this committee.
Well, but understanding how what we're saving here by doing this kind of is, I think... You know. I want to know what this does.
Okay, then let's go about just a little bit different way. Okay. Representative McGuire, will you state again what you meant by that, and then we'll go on.
Sure, Madam Chair. Anytime we make a commitment to utilize government entities, government resources, it is my humble opinion, and it's okay if you disagree, but I agree with the chair, this is, probably isn't the place to have the debate. Maybe it's in Ways and Means or Finance Committee. But it's my humble opinion that when we commit to utilizing our resources in this state to help put together registries, to help whatever the project is, that we are committing Alaskan resources to do that. The Division of Motor Vehicles is funded in large part, and in most part, if you want to be specific about that agency, by the fees that we pay to get our driver's license. So Alaskans are paying to the Division of Motor Vehicles in probably even a more direct form than we are, for example, to fund the Division of Natural Resources or so on. But my point is that when I put this bill through, and my apologies that this created a sideline, I wanted you to know my intent and the representations that I made when I agreed to make this a priority piece of legislation and go and pitch this to the Division of Motor Vehicles and really work with them. And initially they had a lot of concerns about how much of their staff time would be spent trying to explain the organ and tissue donor registry, the heart on your driver's license, how much of their time would be spent collecting that registration and then getting it into the registry itself. And I wanted to allay some of those concerns, and so I made the pitch that I thought the overall benefit to Alaska and to Alaskans that could receive and donate organ and tissue was a good thing. And eventually, if Dwayne Vanek's watching, in his good graces, he agreed, and we worked very hard to get that done. My intent in the bill was never that the registry would be housed outside of Alaska in Alaskan's control. And so that's what I was trying to go to, was my motive and my intent as the bill's sponsor. This legislation right now is technical in that it corrects parts of the bill that I meant to be there, and in some cases didn't mean to be there. For example, in technician, and I wish I'd gotten it perfect, but in the area of technician, we went ahead and created a more narrow definition of it than we really intended to, and went back and looked at the reality of what we have here in Alaska and said, my goodness, We don't want each one of these technicians to have to be licensed by the medical board. So those are, I was trying to articulate the places where I feel I failed to carry out my intent.
Bruce, would you kind of go into a little bit again why it's important that we have something in place here in Alaska? Can you kind of just kind of go into that a little bit for us?
Yes, Madam Chair. Again, in Alaska, donation occurs for both organ and tissue. Most of the donation is tissue donation, and the registry, as we had it designed before the state was involved, we had our own Life Alaska registry that had about 65,000 people through volunteer actions. And this registry was designed for Alaskans to be represented within the state. And when we adopted the state Alaska donor registry with the Division of Motor Vehicles, the intent was the same, but that the mechanism to register would become easier during the license renewal or other DMV activities. And it was our intent, and it continues to be our intent, that the registry remain in Alaska, that others who have authorized access to the registry would have full authorized access going forward, but that we believe the intent and the control and the operation of the registry shall stay within the state to take advantage of other future opportunities that would include the permanent fund and other vehicles by which registration could take place, in addition to the license renewal.
Bruce, I have a question for you. Now, and we do things a little bit different in Alaska than they might do in Washington. One of the big things is that when there's an accident or something happens, we're way out in the boonies many times, and it takes a while to you know, just for them to come every time that they would have to come all the way from Seattle would be a huge extra expense when you can do it here the majority of the time.
That's correct.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I guess what puzzles me is there's this extra cost and expense, and part of it is involved in encouraging people to register, and I applaud that absolutely. I wish every person who didn't have a religious reason to not sign up would do so, because it saves lives. And I think it's the principle of it is really great. It's just the issue of having an Alaska registry, because the tissues and organs that are from people donated on our registry, those are not used only in Alaska. They're available to the entire region, right? And similarly, if somebody here needs a transplant, they get it from wherever. And what troubles me the most, I guess, is that the cost and expense of setting up a registry when one already exists. And certainly we can encourage people to do it more through the DMV or through the PFD application form, but they could be doing it on the Western States registry at no additional cost.
Well, there certainly is a cost. It's and we would bear that cost if it was not in Alaska, because we would be responsible to help maintain that other registry.
Okay. And where does that money come from?
From our own funds.
Life Alaska's funds?
Life funds.
Why would Life Alaska be responsible for the registry in Seattle, for the Alaskan portion of it?
Since we have Alaskans listed, and we would benefit from knowing if they were on the registry, there would be a fee for that service.
A fee from?
To access that registry.
Life Alaska would have a fee to access it?
Yes.
And who pays that fee? I mean, sorry, Life Alaska, why, if I'm an organ donor and I want to sign up and I go ahead and I'm on the Seattle registry or the Western States registry, why would Life Alaska have to pay a fee to find that information?
Well, we are operating in Alaska, and if you're an Alaskan, let's say you that example, the registry is located out of state, that registry costs money to build and to maintain and to continue to operate. There are software costs and so forth. Mm-hmm. Those are borne by the users of the registry.
Okay, and why are you the user if I'm the dead person and my organs?
We're authorized to access the registry, not the public, for the purpose of determining who's a donor. It's confidential information, and part of the actual statute is that it shall only be used for the purpose of determining whether somebody is a donor.
If I'm a donor, I have...
Representative Gardner, do you have a series of questions continuing here?
Well, I'm just
here?
Trying to understand. I mean, I'm trying to follow the money when it comes down to it. Where the costs are and where the benefits.
Do other states that access, the, like, for instance, Oregon, do they pay also to access the Seattle area?
Well, Oregon is not on that registry, but the states of Montana and Washington are.
Okay.
And so there are other programs within those states besides Life Center Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to have access to that registry.
And
so
they, do they pay also?
I do,
like,
not know, I do not know what they pay. No,
okay.
I do not know.
All right.
I guess, like, my question is, if you'll bear with me, if I'm a person, I'm a donor, and I have a donor card, and I go in the hospital and I die, and my organs are available for harvesting, and the hospital contacts the organ procurement organization, would that cost Life Alaska anything?
No, the hospital contacting is, that's not a cost. It's the cost of maintaining the registry and then accessing that registry to determine if somebody is on it. That's where the cost. The calling of, from the hospital, that's a different. That's not the cost. That's a separate requirement to call on deaths or potential imminent deaths. Accessing the registry and maintaining the registry and continuing to develop the registry to take advantage of technology, that's where the costs come in.
So that would be a cost to the state, not to Life Alaska.
No, the state will bear no costs for this registry. We are bearing the cost of the registry right now.
Okay, so when it comes to who is Life Alaska, I mean, if we didn't have the Alaska registry, why have a second registry? I still don't understand why we should have a second registry, just because it's Alaskan? When we can't harvest or transplant organs here.
But we do very little organ transplant, very little of the harvesting that's done here is organs. It's mostly tissue.
Okay.
You know, bone, corneas, uh-huh. You know, skin. So skin even, lots of that.
So it's really for the tissue transplant stuff. That's what we're on about. So, okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative McGuire.
Just one more point, Madam Chair, and I know one of the things I was just saying to Paul, it's hard too, Representative Gardner, because you walk in no different than I walked in, and there, the bulk of the legislation and the policy decision went through last year. And so you're coming in and you're trying to see it all play out and, like you said, follow the money. And those are good questions. So I value the questions that you had, and my apologies for not going. I had Vanessa just sort of present what this bill does and to help me out, because I have 20 irons in the fire today. I could have gone through, and I have another committees with sort of the overarching goal of the original bill, and so my apologies. But one other further point that I did want to make. In addition to this use of resources through the DMV, which I don't want to minimize because these are incredible state workers that help us out, Life Alaska, through their donations, does pay. And I did want to make that clear on the record. And we have initiated in this state what's called Donate a Dollar. So when you go to sign up to hopefully become an organ and tissue donor in Alaska, we ask you, the DMV asks you, would you like to donate a dollar to Life Alaska to help support organ and tissue donation efforts? And it's mainly getting out the word about it. So it's just one other thing I wanted to put on the record that I didn't mention about the money.
Representative McGuire, did you have...
I have two amendments.
There's no one online, so is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on this? Okay, so public testimony is closed. And I see here an amendment, so Representative McGuire, do you want to...
I do, Madam Chair. I would move amendment number one, which, in explaining in my motion, essentially eliminates a fiscal note. It wasn't our intent to create more work for law enforcement, and we did inadvertently by requiring them to send the document. So we got a fiscal note back that talked about postage and envelopes and other things like that. And so we just want to take that out. The Department of Health and Social Services has asked us to, and they feel that they can get that notification through phone calls, through email, through whatever the mechanism is that wouldn't require the fiscal note.
Having heard no objection, that amendment has passed.
Okay, and then amendment number two, bear with me, my apologies, it's not written out, would be to section 1352-200E1, which...
What page?
I'm going to find it for you.
Page 2, line 25.
There you go. Page 2, line 25. And what I'd like to do, Madam Chair, in amendment number 2 is to delete "and a procurement organization." The hospital already has an obligation to notify the organization under Section A and F, and the burden should not be imposed additionally on the first responders. So we just, again, don't want to create a bureaucratic layers for people to have to walk through. So that would be amendment number 2. It could be conceptual so that the drafter could look at the language I have here, but it would strike "and a procurement organization."
Hearing no objection, amendment number 2 has passed.
And that's all I have.
All right. Do I hear a motion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I make the motion, I just wanted to compliment you for your advocacy last year in serving in the legislature for my first term. I thought this was one of the more important bills because I think it brings such an important and needed aspect of our DMV and public safety and health process into this registry. And I went actually to get a new driver's license. Certainly am a donor, but I saw the new pamphlets that you have at DMV, and I think those are really remarkable. Of course, I specifically said that they could only take my brain and specifically the humor parts of it. That's such a genius level. But I appreciate the bill, and so I make the motion that we move House Bill 214 as amended with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 214 as amended with individual recommendations and zero fiscal notes has passed. And next we will go to House Bill 13, School Construction Bond Reimbursement, with Representative Carl Gatto. And is Representative Gatto going? Here he is. Okay. And we will discuss this bill. And
where did the money come from?
And is there Representative Gatto, go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you. we've discussed HB 13 a couple of other times here. I would assume it's somewhat familiar. There's a couple of points that I can emphasize that the bill will allow, at least in the area where I'm more familiar, the construction of 3 elementary schools, 2 of which I believe are in Representative Coring's area and 1 which would be in my area. There will also be money for the construction of a high school, assuming that the citizens of the valley are willing to bond 30% of the cost. So we'll be asking the people that will be using the schools to come up with about $24 million in bonded indebtedness. Unless that happens, then there would be no construction. I only want to leave you with one single point and nothing else. That is, there are 600 kids that will show up this year, standing in the rain, if you want to call it that, with no school to go to. And next year, those 600 and 600 more, and the following year, those 1,200 and 600 more, or even more, because of the growth in the valley, for which no one has indicated will even level off, much less reverse. The growth is exponential and substantial. These are 600 warm bodies. This is not a number of dollars or a number of things or a number of issues. It's 600 kids with no place to go, and then 1,200 and then 1,800. So I'm asking for you to allow us to put up 30% of the money and have the state put up 70% of the money. That is exactly the state's wish and obligation, to essentially allow for schools to be built in the areas where they're needed. I cannot begin to tell you how strong the need is. And so I ask you to consider this issue. 600 kids a year on top of the previous year. Thank you.
Okay, and online, we have Kim Floyd from Matsu School. And Kim, go ahead.
Well, I've had the opportunity to speak before this committee several times, so I don't want to beat the dead horse. I just cannot reiterate strongly enough how much these schools are needed. I appreciate Representative Gatto's leadership on this issue and hope that it is possible, even though you plan just to discuss it today, that this bill move to finance so that we can continue the discussion and hopefully have some schools out here to deal with our overwhelming growth. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else on in the room that would like to testify?
I had a question for the testifier.
Kim, go, or Representative Seaton, go ahead.
Yes, on talking about the schedule for this, if this bill passed during this session, when would it go for a vote before the MATSU, and when would construction be completed on the first of the schools you're talking about?
At tomorrow evening's regular school board meeting, the board will consider a bond package to forward to the assembly with the hope that we could have a October 4th, I believe, vote. The current timeline we're working on in our borough allows for a school to open approximately 3 years after it is voted on by the public. However, we are working with our borough and developers to fast track that process because 2008 were it to be passed in this legislative session would still mean that we're growing, you know, 800 students a year. We're still going to be facing issues even if this bill passes. However, if it's delayed another year, it's only going to mean I don't even know what it means. We're at a crisis point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just wanted to state for the record that I again applaud Representative Gatto for his advocacy for this, and I know that I actually compliment you too because you delayed so long to allow people the latitude to really investigate. I've talked with the school district, both school districts, and they're really supportive, and I just hope that we can move this on because it's time sensitive. And so when you're ready for the motion, if there's any questions, I'll delay and then I'll move it on.
Public testimony is closed, and there's an amendment.
Madam Chair, I believe that Representative Kapsner dropped by an amendment that I'd like to make, and her aide is here to speak to kind of some background on this amendment, if that's possible.
Okay.
And of course, Representative Kapsner is part of the Bush Caucus, and we had discussed, if you all remember, the fact that that some of these rural schools have been left out of some of the maintenance work that needed to be done, and they also have a crisis and have had crises for years in some cases, and this would address that. Would it be possible to ask Pat Jackson to come up and speak to this? And I might just throw in that, as I understand it, Representative Gatto got an opinion from the legal services on the Casile case, and their read was, may I mention that?
Sure.
Oh, good.
Okay with me.
If I may read, the last paragraph was, the most conservative approach to avoid a Casile type of challenge with the extension in House Bill 13 would be to either fund concurrently some of the REAA projects in an appropriate bill or to find another REAA funding source to meet some of the part of the identified need. This assumes, however, that necessary appropriations and voter approvals are obtained to implement House Bill 13. So, in other words, that we could keep ourselves out of running into the embarrassing situation of having the courts telling us that we're not, you know, that we're
leaving important parts of the state out or important responsibilities out. But anyway, pardon me, I didn't mean to interrupt.
And I'm sure, should Representative Gatto have a copy of this so we know if he agrees?
It's his.
Oh, it is his.
Oh, yeah. Have you seen a copy of the...
I have read it one time earlier today, and I've been on the move since that time, and so I don't even have it with me. But I do remember a couple of things that got my attention. I have it right here in front of me now. A couple of things that got my attention about Casale. You know, in the past, the courts ruled that we need to do something, and we agree, but we don't fund it. And that's how we get away with it. We just don't fund it. If indeed this amendment will allow us to maybe satisfy what the court has insisted we do, it does something for those people and it does something for the other people. And so I have no objection to allowing the single bill to take care of both issues. It could be two bills, it could be one bill. I think it's easier for us all when it's in a single bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Pat, why don't you come up and join Representative Gatto?
My name is Pat Jackson, and I work for Representative Mary Capson.
Would you like to just explain the amendment and exactly what it does?
What we did is we asked legal services to help us craft language that would take the approach similar to what we did with the bond package in 2000 that would provide some linkage between bonded school indebtedness and going down the list for schools that are not able to bond. And so the amendment came back looking a little strange because what they did is they pulled language from House Bill 2003 that put that fence around those school districts that are not able to bond. And so they are in the amendment for the time period that the 18-month window that Representative Gatto's bill addresses for the school bond indebtedness. When we talked to the drafter, she said it would be easier if we had a dollar figure rather than a conceptual amendment because this window is going to close. And so the amendment before you suggests $100 million. And I believe that the estimate for the bond debt reimbursement at this time is $100 million, $100,000 a year. And I want to keep that. I'll take that back because I'm not real accurate on that. But we are going on with reimbursement of school bond debt, and this is an effort to address some of the concerns that the Casale lawsuit brought out in terms of the needs out in rural schools also.
Okay, and I believe that I think when Eddie Jean's testified on that, when we asked him how much, he said it could be $100 million. He didn't know because there was no way of knowing how many schools would apply for that. So that it is open-ended, and rather open-ended. So, Representative Sisna.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that amendment.
Hearing no objection, the amendment has passed.
Wait a minute, Madam Speaker. There I go again. Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to object to the amendment so that I can at least... no, it's not. You rushed the process.
I waited.
Wait okay. 1 second.
Do you want to move that we rescind?
I guess I don't have any choice.
Well, go ahead.
I'd like to move that we rescind the previous motion.
Okay. Hearing no objection, then that motion has been rescinded.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Now,
Madam Chair, I move the amendment.
I'd like to object so we can get some further information, clarification on the issue here.
Okay.
Carl, if you could, if you wouldn't mind addressing it, perhaps you won't be able to fully, since the issue seems to have just been thrust before you within the last few moments here in regard to the amendment. What effect could this potentially have in your mind? And perhaps this might be a better question for the Department of Education, which apparently they're not here. But what effect, in your mind, if you understand this amendment, will this have on the Mount Susan's ability to be able to secure the bond debt reimbursement monies? And do you see this as a competing measure to urban areas and getting monies that they feel they need for their rapidly growing areas?
There's a lot of issues right there. I think with regard to the Valley's ability to address the bond debt reimbursement, the fact that we would put up our 30% has substantial support. This information comes from Kim Floyd, who's online, who did a survey, 600 and something, if I recollect correctly, and had a substantial number of people, including very conservative Republicans who typically might be more even about this, but the number was either, I don't know if she'll correct me, 75% or some number like that approved it. The issue of the reimbursement happening, I think, is reasonable to assume it will. Now, with regard to the other issue of the state coming up with enough money for their share, this amendment addresses a $100 million limit. And so we're capped at $100 million. If more people apply, that would be up to the state, subject to the confines of the amendment, to say, we only have $100 million. We can give it to the first in, first out. We can do it proportionally. But it would be a decision that would simply limit the amount of money to the $100 million because that's what is here, unless that number changes. That's my thing. But there's another thing I'd like to add. A member from the other body has proposed spending permanent fund earnings for school construction. That also could enter into the equation that we're considering here, in that some of this for school debt reimbursement may not even be necessary. And consequently, the $100 million cap here may not even be reached with regard to the urban schools, which would conceivably keep the money available to go further down that list of the required schools that the Casile lawsuit addressed. So there are several things. I think I have mentally got my arms around the possibilities, but the thing I have my arms around the most is 600 kids, and as Kim Floyd mentions, 800. Mm-hmm. And you know, as we grow, it might be 1,000. I wish I knew, but those kids are out in the cold. Mm-hmm. We don't have a place. And if we were saying we have all these immigrants, a burnt out town, we would find a place. We would do something on an emergency basis. Quite frankly, I think the situation is an emergency. Mm-hmm. And if someone, wants to challenge the fact that it's an emergency, I'm okay. Most districts are losing population. They have existing schools that are making them more expensive for them, but the kids have a place to go. We don't have a place.
Can I follow up on that, please, if you don't mind?
I mean, I don't think there's any question in anybody's mind that the need is there. I don't think that is a question at all, and I think everyone realizes that.
May I follow up on that, please? Thank you very much. Since we're on the subject of increasing enrollment, and obviously we've got a population explosion in the Mat Su, and we do need to build some more facilities, and I appreciate your efforts. I'd like to get to the question of rural Alaska and what kind of enrollment increases are we seeing there. Would you please answer that? Is it Mrs. Jackson?
Yes, to the chair, Representative Coring, I can't answer that question directly, but I do know that, you know, in Representative Kapsner's district that there are growing numbers of kids and they have overcrowding issues, and I'm not sure school by school. I don't have that kind of an analysis with me, but I know that that's happening, and I know that a part of it also is, you know, some districts having old schools, old BIA schools that are insufficient and having kids in closets, but I'm not able at this point in time to tell you exactly which schools and what situation they're in.
Thank you.
Representative McGuire.
Yeah, through the chair, Yeah, I think the chair is just right. I don't think anybody disagrees that we have needs both in the urban areas and the rural areas. That being said, this is a complex issue because one of the things I like about the grants is that it requires local communities to make a contribution, to make some kind of an effort to say, we want this school, we need this school, and we're willing to step up to the plate and sacrifice to have it. It's difficult to turn that equation toward rural areas by the same measure. They don't have the ability to bond, as we've discussed. That's one first barrier. But then you get down to the next barriers, and I just kind of want to explore, and maybe Representative Kapsner has talked to you. I know, for example, Representative Bundy has a bill right now that would ask for $100, the old school tax credit. Is it what? $400, the old school tax credit. What, if any, amount is appropriate to ask of these rural schools to make in the way, and not just rural, because it's a rural education attendance area, it's a municipal school district that has a population of less than 1,000. And then it could also be a municipal school district that operates schools on a military reservation. Well, that would be Government Hill area and so on in Anchorage. Is it appropriate that we ask for some contribution? And if so, what's the appropriate amount or way?
Through the chair, Representative McGuire, right now there is a participating share that is listed on the school construction grants. You know, in just school construction, our current list has $527 million in requests, and the state share in that is only $432 million. So I know one district, for example, they're looking at their contribution to a project as land that they're able to contribute. But there is a dollar figure associated, listed on the state's list that says that it's the local share.
Representative McGuire, follow
Thank
up.
You, through the chair. And just following up, I would just, you know, I admire Representative Kapsner's leadership in this area. And I, you know, as two young women coming into the legislature, roughly the same age, she's a little younger, but we don't talk about that. And roughly the same time period in life, from dramatically different parts of Alaska, living our whole life here, I feel we've had the opportunity to learn a lot from each other. And she has taught me a lot about what life is like in her part of Alaska. And I have a tremendous amount of empathy and understanding. That being said, bringing it back to her, and I'll talk to her personally, I'd love to see some leadership from her in this area. I think the idea of giving land is a great idea. Whatever it is that you can give, but some way of showing that the people in the community not only support it, but are going to take ownership. And I know that has been a problem, boy, not only in rural Alaska, but it's been a problem in urban Alaska. You know, we have people vandalizing our schools and not taking care of them. But I just invite some leadership on that subject. And I don't know the way to craft it, but I think when you're talking about this part of it, the grants where there's a state match with a local match, how could we expand the type of local contributions that we could ask?
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, I don't know if we're getting a little far away here, but one thing that we have to remember is that, you know, there has been a movement to create boroughs so that they would donate. And we actually found it in two of the last three boroughs that were formed, it actually costs the state money. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is the federal government gives to the REAAs, but as soon as it's a borough, then there's a maximum of 23% match that can be made from that local. So we are actually getting more funds in many of these areas than that go to the school from the federal pass-through that is then stopped if it's a borough, and then we actually have to take money out of the existing schools and shift it over to fund those. So it's not as if no money is going from those areas. It may not come from a house assessment, but there is money matching, and that's one of the big factors that has created this problem with forming boroughs, because the borough, depending upon which boroughs you want to form for school funding, can actually cost our schools money because of the cap, the federal cap that's imposed. So I just wanted to bring that to everybody's attention.
Actually, the amount of money that local, you know, in a, like the amount of money that Anchorage pays, the municipality of Anchorage, that they pay to the to the school to help run the school, so the state doesn't have to pay that portion. Right. Well, the feds pay that portion in those other areas.
Okay. That answers a lot.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you very much. And I agree, Representative McGuire, that that Mary Capster has been a real voice of leadership in terms of every single year she talks about some of the same, the very same schools and some of the very same conditions that have occurred over and over and over again. And that's why this bill is such a good bill, because it's dealing with problems that are occurring right now. And those problems are ongoing problems, but they're occurring right now and they need to be addressed right now. And this bill is one way that that can happen. And it's a way, and as Representative Grunberg said, this is work with the Bush caucus allows this to happen. And maybe amounts need to be tweaked or something like that, but it is a way to pull those two needs together. Absolutely, Matsu Valley is growing and it needs to have problems addressed. The Bush areas, in their own way, are facing their own challenges, oftentimes with increased enrollment, population growth, and this addresses ongoing problems, big problems, in both areas.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify. It seems to me that the amendment doesn't state that this is a total of $100 million, but this is a $100 million cap on the rural school construction grant fund for rural, so that would match up with the estimated 200 plus million that would be authorized under the bonds. Because the bonding, as we talked about the other day with Eddie Jeans here, estimated with Anchorage and Matsu alone, nothing in Fairbanks or Kenai or any of the other municipalities, would be around $200 million minimum. I mean, that was identified amounts, and in no way does it, this gives 18 months of unlimited new schooling, new debt reimbursement. So it could be much more than $200 million. The original bond issue C that went forward, the initial estimates, you know, thumbnail estimates by the department was $500 million, and it came in at $729 million for bond debt reimbursement. So anyway, that's on page 2, line 25, where you see the $100 million for the school. And so if I'm incorrect, and this is a total cap of $100 million being the school grant fund plus it's also a limit on the bonding ability, and that's a total cap of $100 million. I would sure like to get that clarified, because that's not the way I read it. I read it as $100 million school grant, rural school grant, and unlimited bonding match ability.
That's what I understand.
Does anybody have an answer to that?
Madam Chair, sorry, I can't answer that.
You know what? I think what we'll do, let's just wait. Let's find the answer to that. And what I will do this meeting, when I will not adjourn this meeting, I will recess this meeting for a call back at a time certain, as soon as we can find some answers to some of the questions that I have and some of the questions here. Perfect. So we're going to set this bill aside right now, and we will go on to our...
Madam Chair, can I just read something? I do have an opinion from Legal Services, and if I can just read it, there's about 5 lines to read it, but it might address that very question. And it's addressed to me from Jean Michelle, Ledge Counsel. First part says, you have asked for this, and here's my answer. I have advised you that a discussion of any effect can only be speculative, since much of the impact of this bill on the rural-urban funding equity issue raised in the case depends on, one, annual appropriations approved by the legislature for school facilities, both for bond debt reimbursement for municipal school districts and for capital improvement projects for regional education areas and municipal school districts, and two, voter approval of bond indebtedness. It sounds to me like it's all combined into this one question of $100 million, since Jean Michelle is saying that it addresses both in the statement.
And we don't want to do something here that would be sorry for. So having said that, we'll set this aside, and we will go on to our next. Thank you very much. We'll go on to the last thing on our agenda today, and that is behind tab 4 in our 3-ring binders, and it's the governor's appointment to the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, and he has forwarded the name of Mrs. Bonnie Gaborik from North Pole, and is Mrs. Gaborik online? She's not there? Has she been? Well, then if we have no one to talk with us about, we'll save that to another day. And so this meeting is recessed until a time certain, and I will get in touch with everyone when we have more information. And some of the questions that I had and some of my concerns are taken care of, and we get a little more for sure what we're dealing with here, because we know the need is great, and we sure don't want to not take care of the need if we can. So having said that, we will recess until I let you all have notice of when time we can get together again. Thank you. Didn't know that.